This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, June 21st. This is our local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Eve Zuckoff and Jeanette Barnes. We'll check in with Sam Houghton at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Ryan Bray at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. CAI's Patrick Flannery will speak with our State House reporter Katie Lennon, and we'll hear from CAI's Gilda Geist. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. The effort by the Massachusetts Army National Guard to build a machine gun range at Joint Base Cape Cod has run into one more hurdle. This one is about the money. CAI's Eve Zuckoff joins us to explain. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
This is a significant project the Guard is proposing. At one point, they said it would require clear-cutting 170 acres. Funding for this had already come through the federal government. Now, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has pushed back some. You had an exclusive interview with Warren this week.
Yes. Warren sits on the Senate Armed Services Committee, which is in the process of marking up the 2025 National Defense Authorization Act. And she told us going into this meeting with this committee that she was keeping an eye on language in the bill that would have granted a one-year extension on a nearly $10 million funding authorization to build the range. So instead of the funds expiring this September, the extension would make the funds expire September 2025, giving the Guard time to perhaps finish the process of getting this controversial project approved. It's currently in kind of a review limbo. But Warren, going into the meeting, said, "I oppose any effort to move forward with the range until the Environmental Protection Agency reaches a final determination about whether the range could contaminate the aquifer that sits beneath the base and provides all of us with our drinking water."
And this Senate committee, it meets in private session for this kind of work, meaning the decisions it makes aren't immediately known. So even though we knew that Senator Warren had this opposition going into the committee, we didn't know what the outcome was going to be.
No, we didn't. And on Monday, I got word that she would like to give us an exclusive interview, letting us know what happened in this strange private session. And she told us that she, at the meeting, told her fellow senators, "Look, with this negative preliminary report from the EPA, which says, yes, there are concerns, actually, that the range could contaminate drinking water, I don't want to spend taxpayer dollars," this is in quotes, "I don't want to spend taxpayer dollars to start moving forward on something that might never be a reality." And clearly, that was effective.
We know that the Guard has been pushing back hard on the draft decision of the EPA. And one of their arguments has been not right at the environmental decision, but kind of at this idea that the EPA shouldn't even have jurisdiction over this project.
Yeah, it's a process complaint. We got access to internal emails sent by the Guard earlier this spring that reveal the Guard believes the EPA doesn't actually have a legal input or approval role in this range project. It's a switch in strategy. Initially, the Guard said that the EPA's findings about risks to the aquifer were incorrect. Now they're relying on the fact that the Guard serves both state and federal missions. So they're effectively saying, instead of the range being a state project receiving federal assistance, where maybe the EPA can step in, this is actually a federal project with federal funding. And the EPA is actually exempt from regulating a project like that, even though it's the same project. It's kind of it's a legal maneuvering that is potentially going to be effective, given the fact that the Guard does serve kind of this strange middle ground state and federal mission.
Well, one of the great things here was that you had a chance to ask Senator Warren about that particular strategy directly, or just the fact that the EPA is, that the Guard is attempting to sideline the EPA in this whole discussion about building the machine gun range. And she answered with some pretty strong language.
She did. You don't often talk to politicians who use such strong language. She said, quote, "I guarantee that the EPA will have a chance to finish its work." And she said there will be no funding going forward until the the EPA issues a final report. It's a really important point because right now the EPA has this preliminary report. We are kind of hoping to see them finalize something. It's been a very long time that this preliminary report has been out there, whether they're going to say, yeah, we are doubling down on the concerns about the aquifer, or, you know what, we've worked with the Guard, we understand, you know, the layout of this machine gun range better, and we are no longer concerned about the aquifer. Either one of those is kind of the potential here, but everything kind of hinges on this report at the moment, and Senator Warren is saying that process will finish if she has anything to do with it.
Where does this leave things for this project? This particular pot of money may not be there for the Guard right now, and the draft report is still not finalized. How are things sitting right now for the Guard?
Yeah, I mean, it's also important context here is that late last month, the House Armed Services Committee also struck similar language for a funding extension out of its own version of the defense funding bill. So now with the Senate and the House on the same page, these specific funds could expire in the next 3 months. This doesn't, of course, stop the Guard from necessarily trying another avenue to extend funding, nor does it stop them from continuing to pursue this range more generally. The Guard wants to build this range to keep soldiers from traveling long distances for training. We reached out to them this week to ask about this kind of latest wrinkle in the funding and did not hear back.
Let's turn to another story you reported this week. The Coast Guard is scaling back the hours at one of its stations on the Cape just as we head into summer.
Yes, the Cape Cod Canal Coast Guard station at the Sandwich Marina will only be staffed 9 to 5, 5 days a week, just for an undefined period of time, rather than what it's historically been, which is 24/7 service, because of course boaters can run into trouble kind of at any moment. This is all because of staffing issues. The canal station is one of 19 stations subjected to scheduling changes across the country as the Guard experiences one of the largest workforce shortages in its 233-year history, according to press folks for the Guard. The good news is that the station will be fully staffed, we're told, and prepared for 24/7 coverage over holiday weekends this summer, like the 4th of July, and other Coast Guard stations in Woods Hole and Provincetown, as well as the Sandwich Fire Department and State Environmental Police, will be around to help boaters if they're in need.
So this Coast Guard station is only keeping business hours,
yeah,
essentially.
Yes.
Weekdays, 9 to 5. You can understand what some of the concerns are, especially as we head into summer. A lot of people boating who may not be as familiar with their boats. A lot of recreational boating happening there in Cape Cod Bay. What did you hear when you reached out to other folks about the implications of this?
Yeah, we heard from town residents who are really worried about this. We also talked to the Sandwich Fire Chief, John Burke. He said, look, this is not cause for panic, but it did require him to begin considering how to best spread his department's resources. You know, so far there have been no major problems, but yeah, the summer season is still young. We're in June. Like, let's see how this goes and kind of keep our fingers crossed, all of us.
That is CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to offshore wind and the relatively new wind area off the Outer Cape. Yesterday, the federal government issued a draft environmental report on a wind area that starts about 20 miles off the Outer Cape. This is in the Gulf of Maine, but it's closer to Massachusetts than it is to Maine. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with plenty of details. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
First of all, remind us about the status of offshore wind in this area off the Outer Cape, and how does this report that just came out fit into that picture?
Sure. The plans for the Outer Cape for offshore wind really are in the very early stages, meaning there are no wind projects proposed yet for that area. And before any projects get planned, the developers have to secure leases to specific locations in the wind area, which also has not happened yet. But what is underway right now is that the federal government is working on the steps to prepare for that leasing. That's called the lease sale, and it is done by auction. The auction is tentatively scheduled to take place later this year. So the agency that handles this, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, has been holding public meetings about this wind area, which, as you said, is in the Gulf of Maine, but closer to Massachusetts. These turbines would be about 25 miles away, So the report out yesterday really is part of that whole planning for that leasing. It's called an environmental assessment. It looks at the possible effects, good or bad, on the environment from the pre-construction work, though. It does not actually include the installation of turbines. It's for activities that are things like geological surveys of the seafloor and so on.
And did it find any problems?
Well, it analyzes the possible effects on a variety of things: water quality, turtles, seabirds, commercial fishing, and things like that. For all of those, it found that this survey type of work would have only a negligible effect or minor effect on those things. For marine mammals, it was a little different. They classified the possible effect as negligible to minor or moderate, depending on the situation. And one potential problem comes for North Atlantic right whales, which, as we know, are critically endangered. So when this report adds the effect of the wind-related activity to the current threats to right whales, things like entanglements in fishing gear, then in that case, the report does say the cumulative effect could be major. Essentially, because the population of right whales is so small that even one death or injury can be a population level event. Now, I want to say, does this mean that they're not going to be leasing here? No, it does not at all necessarily mean that. Right whale risks are identified as major in these reports pretty frequently. Again, based largely on the background risks that they are already facing, mainly from the fishing gear and vessel strikes. And these risks that they identify can be reduced by restrictions that would be placed on developers. And as we know, also, the federal scientists say there's no known links. There are no known links between the deaths of large whales and offshore wind. So, there are obviously there are very serious concerns for right whales for a number of reasons, but are those concerns going to be considered incompatible with wind energy in the Gulf of Maine? Not necessarily.
Now, you talked with a member of the Whale Fleet Select Board about his views on offshore wind off the Outer Cape specifically. Did he have any concerns?
Some he did, yes, some. I talked with Ryan Curley from the Whale Fleet Select Board, and he's the first person I called because he attended one of the recent Zoom meetings on these wind plans. He says really one of his big concerns right now is what he considers a lack of public outreach on the Outer Cape by the federal government. The agency, BOEM, has held public meetings, but Curley says many people didn't know about these meetings. This is considered not just a project off the coast of Massachusetts, but also New Hampshire and Maine. And the recent set of open houses that they had in person, there was only one per state. So the Massachusetts one, there was one, and it was in Danvers, about half an hour north of Boston. They did also have some Zoom meetings as well. Another issue Curley identified was whether the Outer Cape would receive any of the economic benefits from wind projects that, will be relatively close to their communities compared to other towns. Would they receive any, benefits from jobs or things like that? That's definitely yet to be determined.
I want to talk a little bit about the how this gets done here. Wind projects off the Outer Cape, they're expected to require floating turbines, at least for some of it. That technology for floating turbines is less developed than it is for fixed turbines, at least here in the United States. Fixed turbines being what we're seeing south of Martha's Vineyard, there where the Vineyard Wind area is going up. So you set out to learn more about floating turbines. Tell us a little bit about how the flotation and the anchoring works for these things.
Sure, yes. To get some subject expertise on this, I talked with a civil engineer, Javier Molinero, whose work right now is focused on floating offshore wind. He works for a consulting firm called DNV, which has done work for the state of Maine and for Massachusetts. So he says that a floating turbine really has three main elements that are not part of a standard turbine foundation and piling. So it has, of course, the floater, which is like the base right at the water surface that makes the turbine both buoyant and stable from tipping over. It has some kind of a mooring system, and then it has anchors that secure everything to the bottom. And there are several different designs for each one of those elements. The different bases have different configurations of mooring lines. Some have a larger or smaller footprint on the seafloor and things like that.
I know you asked about the mooring lines and how they work and whether there's a risk of entanglement. What did he have to say about that?
Yes, this is an interesting one. I'm genuinely curious about this because we know, scientists consider entanglement to be a major killer or an important killer of right whales. So, right whales do use this area where these turbines are expected to go. So, if each of these floaters has three mooring lines, let's say, and some of the designs show they have slack in them, is that a threat to whales, right? Is it? I think that's a good question. And if it's not a threat, why not? So unfortunately, right now, the engineer's answer to that question is somewhat general. He says developers and consultants like him are all around the world are working on these issues to try to minimize the risk. He does say one way to do it is to minimize the footprint of the mooring system. And he also points out that the areas they're using for offshore wind have been pre-screened to minimize the risks to the environment as well, right? Like the Gulf of Maine area started out millions of acres larger than it is now, but scientists look at the pros and cons of different areas and then narrow it down.
And he was also pointing to there's multiple different types of systems they could use, depending on, as they start to narrow in on what exactly would work best in a specific area. So it's hard to speak too generally about it. It's a fascinating discussion you really had with this engineer. We have it on our website. People can start to get a sense of what floating turbines are about and how they're different than fixed turbines and what might be the impact of having them go up on the Outer Cape there, 20 miles offshore or somewhere in that region. That's CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. The Steamship Authority, which runs ferries back and forth to the islands, Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, faces plenty of mechanical and logistical challenges. Now it's also dealing with workforce issues. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with this. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
This has become visible recently in the form of yard signs and windshield signs and pins that people are wearing. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, this is about union captains and pilots, what we call deck officers. There are likely others involved, too, in this kind of labor dispute, but this story we looked at, these deck officers, and their current contract ends in July, and they're pushing for better pay and for better hours. We spoke with a number of captains, and what they told us, they work a schedule that's, 18 hours. What it is, 18 hours with a 24-hour period. So essentially, they work a 10-hour shift, rest for 6 hours, and then work another 8-hour shift. The problem, they see that 6-hour in-between rest period, the steamship crew, they aren't paid, and oftentimes they have to sleep on a bunk or on a boat. If they live off island, they may have to stay while the boat is tied up. And the captains we spoke with highlight kind of two issues here. They're saying these hours are creating kind of a safety concern with the exhaustion that comes with that and running the ferry. But they also say that the schedule is making it harder for the steamship to hire personnel. And they say that's leading to what you were referring to earlier, these crew shortages, which islanders know a thing or two about.
It's interesting. One of the things your article goes into here is that the Steamship Authority has a specific exemption from the Coast Guard in order to keep these hours, these captain's hours, 18 hours in a 24-hour period, because that's not actually what the law calls for. The law calls for much less.
Yeah. And the captains are arguing, this isn't common practice in the maritime industry. Actually, right, with that special permission from the Coast Guard, it allows them to give them that 18 hours within a 24-hour period. And I think, interesting, it's not the first time the steamship has been warned, about these hours in our story, we note that a 2018 report, and remember 2018 was that year of hundreds of cancellations, but that report basically made the same assertions that captains, you know, are making, that these are long and tough hours, and it's hampering, you know, recruitment. And I think we should dive into these shortages a little bit. They have been a problem. It's not, you know, maybe not as bad as 2018, not nearly as bad. But, you know, there have been some on the Nantucket route, the Vineyard route, and a big one that impacts a lot of vineyarders when coming home from February vacation. Just one captain called out sick, and there were something like 150 reservations impacted. You know, travelers, granted, you know, islanders weren't happy. And, you know, what the deck, you know, and I think what's important to highlight here, what the deck officers want is to work kind of a 1 12-hour period within that 24 hours.
What does the Steamship Authority say? You guys reached out to them, too, and they're the other part of this equation. They're trying to balance a lot of different parts of their operations here.
Right, and I think it's important to say this is an ongoing labor dispute, so both sides typically hold their cards pretty tight, but they've been kind of quiet responding to us. But they have spoke at public meetings, and they say, you know, it's not just Woods Hole Vineyard that is having these labor shortages. But this is really around the maritime industry. It may be worse here, though, because, you know, the difficulties with housing that we all experience. But we also did some reporting I thought was kind of interesting that some ferry lines around the country have been facing this, but they've made some changes. I think one in New York, they almost doubled the salary for sort of their crew. So, right, I think in the coming weeks, I know we're following up on this story. I think it'll be interesting to see where this kind of shakes out.
You say that the contract is due to renew in July. There's no threat of a strike here now because these captains, they can't legally strike. Is that right?
Yeah, that's been interesting. I know there has been reporting that there was kind of one way to describe it, maybe an informal strike. But the captains we spoke to are saying, no, that's not true. We don't plan on having any kind of strike. We're trying to work within the bounds. We know we provide an essential source to the islands, and we have no intention of disrupting that. That's at least the captains we spoke to. There could be others out there trying, but from this story we have, that's what they're telling us.
That is Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hey, Sam, good to have you back.
Thanks, Steve.
A closely watched story in Orleans revolves around the development for affordable and workforce housing of a property the town purchased some years back. Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with updates here. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Steve.
Ryan, the property at issue here is the former Governor Prince Inn, and now a developer has been selected for the project. And even this process of selecting the developer was caught up in some controversy.
Yeah, this has been a sort of a long time coming, relatively speaking. The town purchased the property on Route 6A back in 2001. And since then, it's sort of been, it's been kind of slow in, forgive the pun, developing. But yeah, to your point, you know, right as, you know, sort of the project came more and more into focus, and there were two developers that were ultimately put in bids for the project. There were, you know, issues with basically how that process unfolded that, you know, up until earlier this month, at a point, it almost looked like this process might have had to go back to the drawing board and go back out to bid. That's until one of the two applicants, Penrose, backed out of the project, and all of a sudden that just sort of created an avenue for this joint application from Preservation of Affordable Housing Assistance Corporation and Habitat for Humanity Cape Cod to sort of move forward.
So these guys, this three-way sort of collaboration has been chosen to develop this property. Now, tell us, their view of it was quite different from the other developer, Penrose, who withdrew, as you say. Tell us what they have in mind for the property, what they proposed, and why the town really moved in that direction. Even before Penrose withdrew, it looked like they were heading in that direction.
Yeah, it was going that way. I think what it really, when you look at the two proposals, what it really comes down to is local developers versus sort of a more corporate national business, which is what Penrose is. Penrose, you know, their proposal is very much in line with other, you know, projects they've done. They sort of have largely a, I don't want to say boxed in, but a very similar design that they kind of go with in many of their projects, whereas I think the thinking from town officials at the end of the whole process was the joint application really honed in more specifically on what the town wants and what the town needs, both in terms of design and aesthetics and in terms of the type of housing available. The town was really put an emphasis on not just affordable housing as defined by the state, but as you said, creating housing for the workforce, so those people that make too much to qualify for affordable housing, but still not, you know, in many cases, nearly enough to afford what housing costs at the market rate. So the joint application from POA, Habitat, and HAC, I think, really drilled in closer to home to what the town specifically needed and wanted from this property.
And in the end, the choice for this came from the town manager, is that right?
Yeah, the town manager as the town's chief procurement officer. It was ultimately her call. This wasn't something that was ultimately voted on by the select board or the Affordable Housing Trust Fund board. This was Kim Newman's call. But again, she had said that as far back as April, she was kind of confident that she liked that joint proposal. But because of the way there were sort of problems with the way the RFP was written, too ambiguous in the language, that caused some problems and some delays as things drew on. Mm. But again, because Penrose backed out, you know, we have a developer for this site, and I think people are very excited about what, you know, comes next, because, as we said, this has been a few years in the coming.
And what does come next?
Now they're going to sort of work out the financing, a land disposition agreement, sort of the particulars that need to be worked out before they can kind of get towards putting shovels in the ground. It's possible that an article for funding of some sort could come before voters at town meeting in the fall. A little too early to tell what that might be. But I think that the big takeaway is, you know, there is somebody they have to really put that site together.
That is Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle, where you can read all about it. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
An airplane made an emergency landing on an East Ham beach last weekend. That's news by itself, but it turns out there's a kind of a historical angle on this as well. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent is here to explain. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
Let me say right here that no one was injured this past weekend, thankfully. But let's start with what happened on Sunday. A small plane taking off from Chatham experienced engine troubles.
Yes, this was a single-engine Cessna 172 that took off from Chatham Municipal Airport on Sunday afternoon on a tour headed for Provincetown, operated by a company called Stick and Rudder Aero Tours. And a few minutes after taking off, the pilot encountered engine trouble, a loss of power. The president of the company that owns the plane, Cape Aerial Tours, said that they don't know the reasons at this point. But the pilot determined that he wasn't going to be able to make it back to Chatham or make it to the airport in Provincetown, and decided to land on the beach in East Ham.
And there were passengers aboard here.
Yeah, the pilot, excuse me, the pilot was a man named Charles Ernst, and he had two passengers, a man and his 12-year-old daughter. The Wellfleet fire chief, Rich Pauley, was on the scene quickly and said that he spoke to all three of them and that they seemed unscathed. He said, actually, they seemed better off than I would have been.
It's hard to imagine that experience for them up in the air, just having taken off and the engine having difficulties and the pilot telling them, we're going to land on the beach here. tell us what happened next, because the plane was on the beach. By the time your reporter showed up, it had actually been removed from the beach.
Yes. So, you know, this is the kind of story that poses a challenge for a weekly newspaper. Mm-hmm. The press release from the Wellfleet police came at 6:22 p.m. on Sunday. We knew that the story would be picked up right away, of course, by other news outlets. Our paper comes out on Thursday. So we did get two reporters, Jack Styler and Cam Kettles, out to the scene early Monday morning. But by then, the plane was gone. And all that was left were some tracks in the sand. So it's kind of a classic story that they call a right around. In other words, everybody was gone from the scene, but the reporters did a fine job of finding people to talk to who could really tell the story. And what happened was, after they determined that no one was hurt, the police, fire, and park rangers from the National Seashore figured out a way to get the plane off the beach. It was actually closer to Marconi Beach in Wellfleet than it was to Nauset Light Beach in Eastham, but the dunes at Marconi are too steep, and so they figured out that they would have to tow the plane along the beach about 2 miles to Nauset Light Beach, and they actually took the wings off the plane, and then a park ranger's truck towed it. It took about 2 hours to go about 2 miles, and they got it off the beach, which protected it from high tide.
One of the things that your reporters then did as they were looking at this was kind of get some context, and it turns out there's a history of beach landings and that pilots are trained in beach landings, and beach landings did not used to be so unusual.
Well, that's right. So the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association has a guidance for pilots on making emergency landings, including on beaches. You're supposed to look for an area of wet, firm sand, and obviously a part of the beach where there aren't a lot of people. And on the back shore in Eastham, in that area, there was hardly anybody. So it was a good choice. The alternative would be a water landing, which, presents other kinds of problems, especially, you know, if the people in the plane end up in the water.
They also reached out to Dan Wolf, who is, for anyone who doesn't know, is the Cape Air CEO and long history of flight in this area. And he seemed almost, it sounded like he seemed almost unfazed as he was talking to your reporters about what happened.
Yeah, he remembers other such landings on the beach. And he told us that back in the 1950s and 60s, small planes landing on the back shore of the Outer Cape were actually common. Pilots would take their planes out there, land on the beach, and go fishing. And of course, at that time, the Outer Cape was a much more remote place, and it was, you know, not that unusual for to see small planes landing on the beach there.
Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Offshore wind turbines are about 15 miles south of Nantucket, which seems pretty far until you're looking at their lights at night. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current joins us to explain what's going on. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
These lights on the wind turbines themselves, they're not supposed to be visible at all times. Is that right?
Yeah, well, these are obviously, put on there as a beacon for aircraft and as, to alert the aircraft to their presence. But part of the deal that was struck between the town of Nantucket and Vineyard Wind is this thing called the Good Neighbor Agreement, and it was about mitigation to Nantucket from the visual impacts of the turbines. And part of what Vineyard Wind agreed to do was to implement what is called an aircraft detection lighting system, an ADLS, which would allow the lights to be off all the time unless a radar detected an aircraft within a certain proximity to the turbines, at which point they would turn on. So they're sort of de facto would be for the lights to be off at all times unless there's an aircraft nearby. Now, that system is not yet operational. And so when you look off the any of the South Shore beaches of Nantucket, you see all of the turbine lights sort of blinking at the same time in unison. And it's pretty jarring sight just from what it was before to see this almost like an airfield out there.
It was supposed to be operational by Memorial Day weekend. What does Vineyard Wind say about this?
Yeah, so we did reach out to Vineyard Wind to ask them about the status of this, and they said that they're making progress on this system. They're working with contractors and construction teams. They called it a very complex technology, and they are addressing some technical challenges that have emerged in recent weeks, and they are obviously prioritizing the safe construction and operation of the wind farm, but they're working diligently to get the ADLS system up and running. So we're going to see how that functions and when it becomes operational, because as I said, right now, this was one of the mitigation efforts that the town negotiated for in the Good Neighbor Agreement, and still waiting to see it come to fruition.
I want to ask you about another story you have this week. It has to do with the historic fountain on Main Street, which is now back in place. It had been demolished when it was struck by a pickup truck last fall. You have an interesting article that points to a question I think a lot of people had, which is about how the restoration of the fountain was paid for.
Yeah, and that was one of the sort of final remaining questions of this story that really saddened people, upset people, and especially, you know, when it turned out and we saw that no one was going to be held criminally or civilly responsible for the destruction. There was a probable cause hearing, which we covered several months ago, and the suspect that the police had brought forward, there was not probable cause found. They basically couldn't put him and determine that he was behind the wheel of the truck at the time that crushed that fountain.
They knew what the truck was. They knew which vehicle it was that hit this fountain.
But they knew whether yes, exactly. That who the vehicle belonged to the owner of Holgate's Laundry. So what the town did was they reached an agreement with a company called Bartlett Consolidated. This is a Plymouth, Massachusetts company, and it provides services to public property owners to, you know, sort of repair and pursue restitution when roadway, you know, things along the roadway that are public are damaged in motor vehicle crashes. So the agreement actually basically turns all the entire sort of situation over to Bartlett Consolidated. They take over and, you know, work with companies to make the repairs, and then they pursue payment from the owner of the vehicle. So they are going after the insurance company, presumably, and the business owner to pursue. So there's no money that the town paid out to have this thing repaired. It's basically turned over the situation to this Bartlett Consolidated, and they're the company that's going to be paid by the owner of the vehicle. So, you know, I think people were obviously concerned that, you know, taxpayer money would be used to repair this when it was clearly should be the fault of the vehicle owner.
In the end, the DPW just, I guess there was the hours they had to pick up all the rubble and then the hours of reinstalling it. But other than that, the rest of the cost is covered.
Yes. So that's what the town told us, was that the only cost to the town was the time spent by the, you know, DPW staff on the site the day of the accident to pick it up and then to reinstall it when it came back to the island at the beginning of June.
It looks nice from the images that you have there. Is it feel good to have it standing back in the middle of town?
It felt sort of empty there at the bottom of Main Street without it, and they did a great job getting it back up. And you've seen people's social media feeds filling with photos of the fountain now that it's back, and people sort of celebrating its return.
Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
With about a month left to go in their formal budget session, Massachusetts lawmakers are packing in plenty of bills. And what was going on this week with the 911 emergency service? Our Morning Edition host, Patrick Flannery, spoke with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon, about the week's news from Beacon Hill. Here's their conversation.
Hello, Katie.
Hey, Patrick. Good morning.
Gabby Giffords, the former congresswoman from Arizona who survived a shooting 13 years ago, visited the State House this week. And Massachusetts, as we know, has some of the strongest gun laws in the country already. What was the impetus behind this visit?
Giffords was here for an event marking the lives lost to gun violence during an awareness month. And her visit came at a time when advocates are really reminding state lawmakers here that, yes, we do have some of the country's strictest gun laws, but they see room to do more. And of course, a bill that would further tighten those gun laws, cracking down on untraceable weapons known as ghost guns and narrowing the list of public places where people can carry firearms. That bill is being negotiated between the House and Senate, who hope to find a deal within the next 6 or so weeks so they can get that signed into law. The bill has been tied up for months in private talks between the two branches, so we as the public don't really know where things stand on that front.
Okay. Well, lawmakers, as we speak, are wrapping up this $58 billion state budget. As we recall, the governor had a version, and of course, the House has theirs. The Senate has theirs. This is the final one, and formal session is almost at an end within the next month. Climate goals appear to dominate this budget. What should people be paying attention to?
Yeah, this budget is another one of a handful of pieces of legislation tied up in those closed-door negotiations between the two branches. They have a goal of getting it done by the July 1st start of the new fiscal year, although that's a target Massachusetts traditionally misses. So lawmakers say they're optimistic they'll get it done this time, but we'll see how that goes. There's a lot of also education spending in this budget, everything from the Senate wants to make community college free and invest more in child care. And there's transportation funding, too. That would be, you know, there's proposals for big boosts to the MBTA here in the Boston area and regional transit authorities outside of the capital region. So lots to watch as it progresses there. And meanwhile, we've got other big bills in the pipeline dealing with everything from housing to the life sciences to a potential ban on plastic bags in retail stores statewide. So a lot of moving parts.
The plastic bag one will be something to watch for sure, especially here on the Cape and Islands where towns kind of set their own policies there. Well, let's talk more about that legislation. There is some aimed at improving pregnancy and postpartum care. What would this mean for parents statewide?
So this is a goal that lawmakers have to really push back on a trend of increasing rates of severe maternal health complications. There was a big increase from 2011 to 2020, and it was disproportionate among racial groups, with Black women experiencing the highest rate. So what the House is looking to do here is expand access to services like midwifery, birthing centers outside of hospitals, and lactation support. They're also looking to require postpartum depression screenings for new parents after birth. So there's a lot of different approaches there to kind of, you know, go from the start of pregnancy to after delivery and make sure families are healthy.
There's also a bill to ban revenge pornography, which is becoming law this week. What took so long to get to this point, Katie, and what do lawmakers hope will happen with an actual law in place? Is it going to change anything?
This bill was actually a priority of former Governor Charlie Baker, who pushed it for years, and it took the two branches, the House and the Senate, a long time to really get on the same page with the specifics, along with officially criminalizing the non-consensual sharing of images, what's known as revenge porn. The bill looks to create diversion programs, educational alternatives to prosecution for minors who engage in sexting, and it would add coercive control to the state's abuse statute. So there's a lot of different things in here that people in the legislature and advocates hope will increase the safety of people who are in relationships, push back against some types of abuse that aren't officially on the books. So it will, it's something that a lot of advocates are cheering.
Finally, Katie, 911 service was down statewide for a few hours on Tuesday. I've never experienced anything like this before. I don't know how common it is. Do we know anything about what caused it and what sort of repercussions there were? I mean, I can only imagine there was a lot of strain on dispatchers.
Yeah, the state did encourage people to call their local police department if they experienced an emergency during this roughly two-hour period this week. State public safety officials have said that there was a firewall problem with the 911 system statewide that actually blocked calls from reaching dispatch centers, which you're right that this is unusual. It's not something we know the exact cause of, other than we've heard from the state that it wasn't a cyber attack or a hack that caused this firewall issue. But it's something the state is still exploring, and hopefully we'll find out more. And they say that the vendor involved here has put a solution in place to keep this from happening again.
Katie Lennon from the State House, as always, we appreciate your insight and your time.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Patrick Flannery speaking with Katie Lennon at the State House. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. 50 years after the state began using busing to integrate schools, segregation is still a problem in Massachusetts. That's according to a report released last week by the state's Racial Imbalance Advisory Council. CAI's Gilda Geist is here with this story. Hi, Gilda.
Hey, how's it going?
This report examined the racial makeup of publicly funded schools in the state, which includes charter schools. What were some of the top line takeaways here?
Yeah, so the report found that at the state level, about two-thirds of schools are segregated. And so my first question was, how is this impacting students? So basically, the report found that the whiter a school is, the better the outcomes for the student body, including non-white students. And when we say outcomes, we're talking about graduation rates, we're talking about MCAS scores, college enrollment, out-of-school suspension rates, stuff like that. Using those same metrics, segregated non-white schools tend to have worse outcomes. And so just like the civil rights movement, the evidence is showing that by and large, there's no separate but equal. Segregation is still disproportionately harming students of color.
Mm. You spoke with the chair of the state's Racial Imbalance Advisory Council who did this report. And in your conversation, you really focused on the Cape region. What did you learn?
Yeah, so Raul Fernandez is chair of the council that did the report, and he helped me localize some of their findings. So just about half of Cape and Islands schools are segregated. The majority of those schools are predominantly white. The Cape and Islands only has two segregated non-white schools. They're both in Barnstable. And so to fill that out a bit, I talked to school committee member Andre King to see what he thought about the data. And King basically said Barnstable is really diverse compared to a lot of districts in our region. And so the fact that these two schools that meet the criteria for segregated non-white probably just reflects the population of the student body. It's not like in Boston where there's quite a lot of diversity within the district, yet you're seeing all these segregated schools. Mm. In Barnstable, there are no segregated white schools. The other seven schools in the district were found to be racially diverse.
One of the concerns that Raul Fernandez from the state pointed to about segregated majority white schools seems to be kind of a loss of important experience for students.
Yeah, so just under half of schools on the Cape and Islands are segregated white, and these schools tend to be clustered in whiter towns like Falmouth, Bourne, and Sandwich, where every single school in the district is found to be segregated white. So while the data shows that these students are enjoying, you know, high graduation rates, low student discipline rates, Fernandez points out that these students are missing out on diverse perspectives. They're growing up in predominantly white communities, going to segregated white schools, and then by the time they get to college or enter the workforce, they've gone through arguably the most formative parts of their lives without ever having had a close relationship with a person of color.
How does the Cape region measure up against the rest of the state in this report?
Yeah, so across the state, just over a third of schools were found to be racially diverse, whereas on the Cape and Islands, just over half of schools were found to be diverse. So the Cape and Islands is actually less segregated than the state as a whole when it comes to publicly funded education. But there is still work to be done to further integrate the schools here and across the state. The report actually includes a series of 18 recommendations for ushering along integration on the state and local levels.
And we have that story on our website where you can actually click through the link to see the report itself. CAI's Gilda Geist, your first time on the Roundup. You're producing Morning Edition with Patrick Flannery. You're reporting. You're hosting the show on Saturday mornings. Great to have you on.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Eve Zukoff and Jeanette Barnes. We spoke with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent, Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. We heard from CAI's Patrick Flannery speaking with our State House reporter Katie Lennon, and of course CAI's Gilda Geist there. Thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. He's not just the OG, he's the OG OG. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.